Well, the interesting thing about Green Day is that so much of their music is, in truth, directly influenced by, in my opinion, two bands.
The Clash.
Correct, Clash. But also by this band called the Stiff Little Fingers. I think you would really love this band.
Sounds great. My name's Anna.
My name's Dick.
Is this the new Green Day?
It's the Lifers Podcast with Scott Lucas, Gabe Rodriguez, and Ben Reiser. And now, here's Scott, Gabe, and Ben.
So, I was wrong. The best Lemonhead song is...
What's the best?
The best song on It's a Shame About Ray, I think it's Confetti. I forgot all about Confetti. I think that's the best.
Confetti is the first song on the album, right? The Kind of Shit of Sorta.
No. Rock and Stroll is the first song.
But Confetti is the Kind of Shit of Sorta Would Have Loved If He Could.
That's the second. She kind of would have sorta would have loved. Yeah.
Great song.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Yeah, I put the record on the way to hang out with Ben in Madison, and I forgot all about that one. I think that might be the best.
Well, I mean, are there any songs, like, you know, there's some albums where I'm like, oh, if only this song wasn't on it, it would be the perfect album. I don't think that album needs any songs removed.
Ceiling Fan in My Spoon, which I think we were saying might be the worst song on the record.
Still good.
It's a really good song.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, I don't need to. And it's Allison's getting her tit pierced. It's not Allison's getting a tit ring.
Right. You were wrong again.
How did we...
Watch the best!
Well, here we are talking about It's a Shame About Ray again. Gabe, you got your first cease and desist over at G&P Records.
Oh?
I did. I didn't tell anybody. Actually, one person knows about it.
Well, now everyone's going to know about it.
Out of the blue, I get this email.
Out of the blue?
Was it from Kai Aaron's saying, don't use my fucking album artwork anymore?
No, yeah. You know how...
You guys suck. You can't use anything I have.
Has anyone heard from Kai since he went to take a shit?
Yes. Oh, okay. We've been texting back and forth.
Oh, good.
I don't think that was public, was it? Did we make that part of the podcast?
Who knows?
No, that's part of the... It is, yes.
Don't tell
him. Him actually taking the shit.
I don't know, but he says, I'm going to leave, I got to take a shit, and then you left it?
It's the finest last word that anyone has ever had on this show.
It's not the first time someone had to take a crap.
Oh,
leave.
Who was it? You?
Kyle Kinane, when he had the...
Oh, that's right.
What do you call it? Cleansing. Right.
If we're not talking about Lemonheads, we're talking about poop. What is with this show? I'm sorry, Gabe. Your first cease and desist.
Yes, I was out to eat. I was out to dinner, and I got this email popped up on my phone. I saw something that said cease and desist. I'm like, it's kind of rude to look at my phone right now. I got to look at it later. So I'm like, I let it go.
So you ceased and desisted from looking at your phone.
Yes. And I'm like, I don't even want to see this email. I don't know who it's from. I don't know what they're trying to say. But the union folks from the Stagehands Union, the IATSE or whatever they're called, you know who they are.
Sure.
Yeah.
We stole their logo for the union logo.
Stole?
Okay.
Appropriated. We borrowed.
Lifted it. I guess they didn't take it too kindly and said, hey, you're misrepresenting our purpose here, and you're going to have to cease and desist.
Oh, that's bullshit.
Now, you remember when we were on tour with Stone Temple Pilots and the people at Madison SDP. Square Garden?
Oh. I believe so, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought we
the Teamsters, those fucking New York Teamsters were not...
Yeah.
into those shirts.
We didn't.
It's like if you appropriated a Hell's Angels jacket or something. It's that kind same of mindset. It is. Yeah. Don't fuck with us, assholes.
No, no. It'd be like somebody from Belfast writing a record about the Troubles. Right. It's kind of a ballsy move. Gabe, who do we have on the show today? This is a good one, everybody.
Today's guest, Jake Burns. Stiff Little Fingers.
What? Jake Fuck Burns yeah. from Stiff Little Fingers?
Oh, yes.
Talk about an icon.
Tell me more.
I can't tell you much, but after listening to some of that stuff
you
today...
You never could.
It's pretty good stuff. I mean, I wasn't exposed to them, but I'm sure you were, so you tell me. Stiff Little Fingers.
This stuff seems like it would be right up your alley, Gabe.
It does. When I played it today, I'm like, this is pretty good.
Yeah. You're welcome.
And it holds up.
It definitely holds up. Stiff Little Fingers is about to embark on what they're calling their final coast-to-coast tour. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not going to play shows. This, I think a lot of people are doing this. I think not a lot, but I think, like, say the B-52s have right. done this recently. Like, they're not going to tour anymore. But, you know, they play shows here and there. And maybe that's just because, you know, Jake, well, doesn't want to rule anything out because he's a lifer. But maybe he also, being a Who fan, has been lied to by the Who one too many times. This is our final tour. Who knows? Who knows, Gabe? Do you know?
I don't know, but you're not far behind him. I mean, there's going to come a day when you're going to have to say the same thing. Hey, I can't make this trip. West Coast, East Coast, come on, pick a coast. And you're going to say, we'll do 2 weeks here and that's it, right? Or are you going to do it till you're 70?
this isn't about me.
I'm just saying, he's a lifer.
Move on. Have you done anything unpunk this week, Gabe?
Unpunk Gabe, unpunk Gabe, unpunk, unpunk, unpunk Gabe. Unpunk, unpunk, unpunk Gabe.
Have I done anything unpunk? A little bit. A little bit. I came across a nice person's social media page, and this chick, this girl.
A nice person's chick. Social wow. media page.
It's a person that I just came across their feed, and it's this girl doing these dad jokes. And she laughs at them so loud that it's almost Wait. More funny because she's doing them.
It sounds to me like something you would do.
Me?
Laugh at your own jokes, yeah.
Yes, it is. It is. I laugh at my own jokes, and she laughs at her own jokes, but they're not her own jokes. They're stupid dad jokes.
Sure.
But I found a new favorite joke of mine.
Uh-oh.
But this one made me laugh more than my favorite joke. So I'd like to share it.
All right. Please. Do you know how to
Gabe
do
Rodriguez, comedian.
A group of nuns are painting their convent on a hot summer day. Mother Superior tells them to hurry up and finish because a blind man is coming. The nuns get so hot from working in the heat that one suggests that they take their tops off to cool down.
Ooh,
Another says, I guess it's okay, it's just a blind man that's coming. The blind man arrives and says, nice tits. Where do you want the blinds?
Nice.
Wow.
You never heard that joke before?
No.
You didn't see it coming?
Well, I'm not blind. So that's not your favorite joke. Your favorite joke is...
No, that's his new favorite joke.
No, that's my new favorite joke. That's
he said it's his second joke. Favorite joke. What's your favorite joke?
This is my favorite joke.
But what's the favorite joke that it replaced?
It's the one where the string walks into the bar and asks for the bartender...
Now, that's
bartender.
A good joke.
Wait, I haven't heard this. Go ahead.
The string walks into the bar, walks up and says, hey, I'll take a... Give me an old style or whatever. Give me a beer. And the bartender says, hey, we don't serve strings in here. Get out of here. He goes out, roughs himself up a little bit, comes back in. I'll take a beer. And the bartender goes, hey, didn't I tell you to get out of here? Isn't that you that I threw out? He goes, no, I'm afraid not.
No. See, nice. I knew you were going to tell it wrong.
Okay. I can't tell it.
String walks into a bar. Bartender says, hey, get out of here. We don't serve your kind here. So he goes outside, ties himself into a knot, messes up his hair, comes back. bartender goes, "Hey, aren't you that string I just threw out of here?" He goes, "No, I'm afraid not."
That is a better telling of that joke.
It sure is.
You did fuck it up.
I laughed at my own joke.
I knew you were going to mess it up.
I've told that joke 100 times.
Uh huh.
Anyway, this other joke passed it up. And every time I see this feed, I got to hear it one more time. And it's hilarious.
I think you just like to say nice tits.
It's funny. Because it. It's hilarious.
Unpunk Gabe, unpunk Gabe, unpunk, unpunk, unpunk Gabe. Unpunk, unpunk, unpunk Gabe.
Ben, what are you doing with your time now? Is there a big film festival-shaped hole in your heart?
There is. And you know, normally my film festival is 8 days long. But this year, as you
know... 8 days a week?
8 days a week. But as you know... This year's festival really went another 2 days.
2 days,
so it was 10 days. It was like an extended bonus round of the film festival. We had Alexander Payne in town. You and I have, and a bunch of goofballs kicked back and watched.
I call him Alex.
Yeah.
He lets me call him Alex.
But anyway, we watched like 4 movies a day with him for 2 days straight. And it was a beautiful thing.
It was a nerd nirvana.
It kind of was. And, you know, I think you were debating whether you were going to stick around for the last movie, Westward the Women, but I think, are you happy that you stuck around?
I was debating. It would have been a major mistake. I'm a big fan of American Westerns, so I don't even know what I was thinking. I think it's, along with being one of the great American film genres, it's also the most maligned. People are like, Westerns. They're boring, and they're never boring. Westerns and musicals, people are like, I don't like those movies. Well, you're an idiot. And this was a great one. This was a really good one. Yeah. Westward the Women. Gabe, have you seen Westward the Women?
No, have not. Probably won't cross my path anytime soon. But
I don't see
if it does,
seeing this.
I'll try and remember.
Sure.
Will it come to Netflix?
No.
But there's not a wasted minute. It doesn't feel... It feels tight as a drum.
Tight as a tourniquet. Dry as a funeral drum.
Mm-hmm.
You know what that's from, Gabe?
No. Tourniquet?
Pink Floyd lyric. Exactly. Now, that's my question is... It's tourniquet, right?
It's tourniquet.
Well, unless you're from the UK or LA, depending on where you think Pink Floyd right. is from.
So why would Roger Waters say tight as a tourniquet?
Is he rhyming it with something else?
I'm cold as a razor blade, tight as a tourniquet.
Oh, there you
dry
go.
Dry as a funeral drum. Well, you can't do that. You can't change a song.
I've heard motherfuckers do far worse than that.
Like who?
Kid Rock.
All right, you know what? We're not going to say motherfucker on this show anymore.
Oh,
you... Ben, are not allowed to say motherfucker on this show anymore. Okay. From now on, you're going to say mother, father.
Okay, mother, father.
What did Kid Rock say?
I don't know, but I know he's done some ridiculous.
Well, according to Kid Rock, Beyonce can never be country. That's what Kid Rock says. Because country people hate woke, and Beyonce is as woke as they come. How do you feel about this? And my question is, who made Kid Rock?
Right, what does he know about country or country
folk?
Fuck
yeah. He's a cowboy?
He can.
That means Bon Jovi's country too.
He can maybe, I don't even want to say he can speak for white trash, because I don't even believe that he's really white trash.
I do. Okay, Gabe.
Yes.
Have you seen this Beavis and Butthead Saturday Night Live thing?
I did see it, actually.
Okay. Your thoughts?
I laughed at it. I didn't even know it was Ryan Gosling, because I didn't know he was guest hosting or hosting. I laughed at it. I laughed at it because of the... Not because of the Beavis and Butthead guy. Because of... what's the guy? The actor who's playing the
Ryan
AI.
Gosling?
No. No, the guy that won't leave the show.
Yeah, the guy who's been on there forever.
Keenan Ivory... Wayne's.
That's not him. But you know who I'm talking about. He's funny no matter what he's talking about. He's hilarious.
Is he?
He's funny.
You want to talk about a one-trick pony.
Yes, and that pony does his trick very well. But anyway, you didn't like the skit?
Yo, I'm a big Ryan Gosling fan, so I like this show. And honestly, the last 4 episodes of that show have been pretty solid. Pretty good. Actually funny, like laugh out loud funny. But I just knew that you would love a Beavis and Butthead skit. Did you watch it live as it was happening, or have you just seen it on your TikTok channels?
It came across my feed, of course, and I caught it. And you
catched it?
It was
he watched it Curb Your Enthusiasm style in little chunks on YouTube.
Right.
No, it was one skit. It was on YouTube. It's the whole thing.
Right. Yeah, you idiot. You mother-fathering idiot.
I did finally see the last episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Okay.
Just so you guys know, I've caught up to the two of you.
Your thoughts, Ben?
I thought it was fine. I was so tired. This was post-festival that I slept through brief moments of it. But it was an extra long episode, wasn't it?
It's HBO. It's not TV.
I thought it was good. I thought it was a nice redemption. If people don't like the Seinfeld ending, I thought this was a nice play on that.
If you don't like the Seinfeld ending, I don't understand how you can like this ending. I think it's nonsense. It's a lesson in herd politics is what it is.
Well, I like the Seinfeld. I have no problem with the series finale of Seinfeld.
I'll tell you what the problem with the series finale of Seinfeld is it was predicated on this idea that, and this is Larry David's idea, that everybody on the show is unlikable. I don't agree with that. I don't think anybody would have watched that show for, 12 years or whatever it was if they didn't like those characters. I certainly wouldn't have. So I think he was like basically hitting the point a little too hard. Yes, they act selfishly, but that's part of the joke. We all do that sometimes. Or in Gabe's case, all the time.
My problem, if I had any, with the finale, and it's the same thing that was true with the Curb finale, is it's all these callbacks, all these characters that have been on through however many seasons come back, and I think you're supposed to be excited to see them again, and I don't know. Right. To me, it's just kind of like, okay, yeah.
It's almost like a flashback clip show.
Well, that's the thing. Then talk about hitting it too hard. They actually then show clips from those older shows, and it's like, I don't need that.
I was mixing Pack Up the Cats when that finale, and I said, hey, we got to watch this. And Nick DiDia, who was mixing the record, he wasn't a fan. He was like, really?
you wasted an hour of studio time.
Yeah. That's how it went back then. Finale. Big rock stars wasting studio time.
Did he say, did DiDia really have to?
Do I? What?
That was a Nick DiDia joke. Play on his last name. I don't think I hit it hard enough.
No, sure. There was once, this goes back to the HBO. It's not TV, it's HBO. Mm. There was another finale that was coming on, or it was the final season of The Sopranos. So Sopranos was playing, we were on the East Coast, and we had a day off, and I was like, hey, we got to stop in a couple of hours because Sopranos coming on. We got to find a hotel with HBO in it. And Brian's like, no, we have to keep driving. I'm like, no, we don't. We're pulling over, and this hotel better have HBO, or we're going to get another hotel. I'll call the hotel, and he's like, I'm not going to get a hotel just for TV, Scott. And I go, it's not TV. It's HBO.
How did the evening end?
Oh, I watched the fucking Sopranos. Hey, everybody. It's Jake Burns. Whoa.
Whoa.
Jake. Where are you?
I'm in the basement of my home in the middle of West Virginia.
That's where you went?
That's where we went. Yeah, that's where we went.
What made you go there?
A number of things, to be honest. I kind of got to 65 years old. And I don't know about you, but when I was a kid growing up, my old man used to like pray for the day he got to 65 so he could quit working in a factory and put his feet up. And so it was kind of always a milestone in my head that when you get to 65, you can put your feet up. Right. I realized, obviously, doing what we do, that's not the case. But mm-hmm. I still wanted to ease off the gas a bit. And I'd lived in cities my whole life, and I kind of fancied living in a small town. And we had family out in this neck of the woods. Shirley's brother lives up in Morgan, just outside Morgantown. So we'd been coming here every Thanksgiving, and I kind of knew that I really liked the area and stuff. And it just made sense to, you know, come look at a few places out here, and we kind of fell in love with the place. So that's how we ended up here.
Is there anywhere to watch soccer out there?
Yeah, my basement.
Okay. Right.
Was it during COVID that you decided to get out of the big city?
Actually, just before. It was around that time that, you know, I, like I said, I was planning. 65 was kind of the milestone I was aiming for. So it was just before that that COVID happened. In fact, I think we came here the first time we saw this area was just before COVID, and that kind of put the, you know, put the kibosh on it for a year or two. So yeah, we've been looking out here for, like I said, about 3-4 years before we moved, and we moved, I think, 1st of June last year. So we've been here just about a year.
Well, it looks like you're about to sort of put your feet up a little bit more, because you're about to embark on the final Stiff Little Fingers tour in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I mean, it's not actually a final tour. I mean, we were trying to word this properly so people didn't think we were quitting completely.
Right.
It's the final coast to coast tour we're going to do here. Simply because I think, you know, I'm just too old to sit on a tour bus for that length of time anymore. It's the last time that we'll head right across the country. I mean, if we get invited to play the odd festival or whatever in the future, we'll do that. And obviously, you know yourself, there's always, you know, room for a few shows around a festival. But it's the last time we're going to do a major tour. I mean, we've already stopped going to Australia and Japan and places like that. And
right.
we cut the traditional UK tour from about 20 shows down to just 9 this last time we did it. And we might even cut that further. But, you know, there's certain things we'll still do. But, yeah, I think the days of the long tours are long behind us now. You know?
Now, does doing it at this time, this year, have anything to do with flammable material turning 45?
Actually, you know, that hadn't even occurred to me, to be honest. No, it hasn't. I mean, we did a 30th anniversary for it. And that was, you know, that was kind of, I mean, it was fun. It was a bit of a pain in the ass to try and learn it all again, because obviously we hadn't played some of the song. In fact, I actually had to phone our guitar player in Los Angeles up and ask him what the fucking chords the middle eight of one of the songs was. And he was like, well, you wrote the damn thing. I went, yeah, but I wrote it 30 years ago. You know, I can't remember it. So, yeah, I mean, it was fun to do. But, you know, playing a whole album is kind of, it upsets the balance of the set. It upsets the balance of the evening completely, you know, because you can't really pace a set. I mean, you can't just play the album and then stop, because the record itself is about 30 minutes long, if that, you know, maybe a little bit longer. So, you know, you have to play like another hour's worth of material. And it means you're front loading. The way we did it was we played an hour's worth and then we played the album to finish. But it means you're front loading the set with a lot of stuff that not necessarily people know. And I mean, you know, what we used to do was obviously you'd play a couple of songs you thought they might know, maybe throw in a new thing that they weren't familiar with, and then play an old favorite just to keep their interest, you know? Right. So if you're leaving basically all the old favorites to right at the end of the set, it kind of unbalances the whole evening. So much so that actually we did one show at the Royal Festival Hall in London, and our tour manager was actually in the box office settling up. And the show had been going on for probably about an hour at that point. And he said he was sat there, and suddenly this irate couple came up and started banging on the window and going, I demand my money back. I came here to hear them play Inflammable Material, and they haven't played one fucking note from it. Literally at that point, we hit the opening chords of the first song. And he went, well, you best go back in. They just fucking started, you know.
In the nick of time. When you revisit a record like that from, you know, I mean, how old were you when that record came out?
I was 20 years old when it came out, 21. It entered the charts a week later. I actually went in on my 21st birthday. So, you know, it's a long time ago.
Okay, so is there some kind of weird time travel therapy thing going when you're thinking about all these lyrics that you wrote when you were 21 and you sort of get in the head of this young man at 21?
It was, yeah, like I said, quite apart from just the trying to remember it. Yeah, I mean, I was, Yeah, it's interesting because people have often said to us, you know, that people, you know, either concentrate on the anger in the record, or the other thing that people bring up is how brave they thought the record was, considering, you know, a lot of the material was written about the situation in Northern Ireland. And they were like, you know, weren't you concerned for your safety and stuff? And at the time, we weren't, not at all. But going back and looking at it, there was an element of, Jesus, were we sure about this? You know, but by that stage, we'd already done it. It was interesting. A lot of it was difficult to go back to because obviously my singing style had changed. I mean, back then it was just basically shouting.
Gargling glass, man.
Right. I mean, that was brought up in a lot of reviews of it and stuff. And, you know, again, sort of since we were talking just a second ago about, you know, dialing back the amount of touring and stuff that we're doing, I looked at the actual tour for that album. And we did something like 36 shows, but in 33 days, there were like a couple of matinees thrown in there. And we didn't, there wasn't one day off. We didn't take a day off at all. So, you know, the thought of going back and doing that now is just horrifying, you know. So, yeah, I mean, there was an element of, you know, boy, we had some stamina back then, you know.
Yeah. But growing up in Belfast, you know, seemed to really form the band or inform the band. What can you say about growing up in Belfast that hasn't been said a million times before?
Well, I mean, that's the other thing is, you know, so talking about that, people say, you know, what was it like? You know, it must have been so weird for you and all that. It really wasn't. I mean, it was, you know, because we had nothing to compare it to. You know, it wasn't like, you know, we'd come from Manchester or something and then been transplanted there. We, you know, that's what we'd grown up with. I was 11 years old when the unrest started. And I don't know about you, but my memories from prior to being about 11 years old are pretty sketchy. You know, I mean, I remember a few things, but nothing in any great detail. So, you know, it was kind of all we knew. I mean, it did inform the band, and it informed what we wrote about. Because again, you know, it's that old maxim, you know, write about what you know. So it was second nature almost. I mean, it was interesting though. It did take somebody from outside to actually point it out to us. It was when we first met Gordon Ogilvy, who became our manager and my co-writer for a lot of the material. We'd written one song with regards to what was happening around us, and that was a song called State of Emergency, which is on the first record. And in a way, we'd almost thought we'd dealt with it. You know, it's a bit like the guy that goes for one session of therapy and thinks he's cured. You know, it was a bit like that. It was, you know, we kind of felt we'd dealt with it in one song. And it took Gordon to go, no, you haven't even scratched the fucking surface yet. I mean, doesn't it annoy you on a day-to-day basis? How do you feel about this? How do you feel about that? And, you know, in a way, it took an outsider's eye to almost point this out to us. And I think it was the second or third time I met him, presented me with what became the lyric of Suspect Device. It was pretty much all there. I always say it was a bit like one of those old sort of, you know, Irwin Allen 60s TV shows, you know. It was a bit like something, you know, suddenly the whole room liquefied around me and all I could see was this piece of paper. I mean, I kind of heard the song in my head, almost just reading the words. And I went home and I put the music to it. And within a day or two, I'd written Wasted Life as well. I mean, it really was like he lit the fuse and stood back, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, before punk, what were you listening to music-wise, obviously?
Well, I, you know, again, and I mentioned I was 11 years old when the Troubles started, and as a consequence of which, you spent a lot more time at home than you might have done normally as a teenager. And also, a lot of my friends were a couple of years older than me, so musically, they were listening to stuff that wasn't, you know, what your typical 12-year-old would have been listening to. So when I really should have been listening to glam rock and stuff, I was listening to Rory Gallagher and Black Sabbath and you know, Led Zeppelin and those people. And Rory Gallagher was kind of my first real, you know, sort of musical influence, if you like. I mean, prior to that, I'd bought the typical pop records that most kids would buy, you know, the stuff that was in the charts. And I mean, actually, when we were unpacking, when we moved from Chicago out to here, and we found a bunch of old 45s that I'd bought. And I hadn't realized quite how many records I'd bought on the Motown label. I had tons of the damn things from when I was a little kid. So that was what I'd been listening to until I heard Gallagher. And he was kind of the first real influence. That was with his band Taste. So,
Would you see like him on TV or something? Or you heard
I did,
him on
yeah. That? Yeah, actually, I was watching. It was since you mentioned soccer earlier, it was the football results I was watching. And so that was like, you know, late afternoon on a Saturday. It was about 5 o'clock in the evening. And when the football results finished, I got up to walk out of the room. And the BBC had recorded Taste's farewell show. And they were showing it in two sections. And that was the first section was shown right after the football results. And it was just the sound of the guitar actually stopped me in my tracks. And I turned around and went back and sat down. And pretty much decided that was what I wanted to do with my life at 12 years old, you know.
Right.
And started bugging my folks to get me a guitar pretty much right away. They didn't. They held out for about 2 years. I think I was about 14 when I got my first guitar. I think basically because, you know, they were, you know, the year before I'd wanted to be a soccer player and I sucked at that, you know. And so, you know, I think they kind of felt that this would be another passing phase that I would grow out of, which is understandable, I suppose, because, you know, guitars aren't cheap, you know.
Right. It's still a phase.
Yeah, it's still a phase, yeah. 66 years old and it's still a phase, yeah.
So how old were you when you formed your first band?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to say whether it was actually a band or not. I think we probably only played about 4 or 5 shows, but it was a school band, you know. I mean, it was like, you know, I guess it would be high school years here would be the equivalent. So I probably would have been 16, something like that, 16 or 17.
Right.
And it was a bunch of friends who... 3 of whom actually became myself and the 2 others became Stiff Little Fingers with a 4th guy added. We called ourselves Highway Star after the Deep Purple song.
Yes, of course.
And of course weren't good enough to play it. So this, that right. One song famously missing from the set, you know, because we couldn't fucking play it. I've got it.
I would want my money back for that one.
Right, we got into a habit then of nicking song titles for band names because Stiff Little Fingers is a song title as well.
So, what was the band that like kicked you over to the punk side? Was there a specific one?
Yeah, the Clash. You know, I really liked, by the time punk rolled around, I was sick to death of the whole 20-minute guitar solo thing. I'd moved on from it. And by that stage, I was listening to the song had become the thing, really, from my point of view at that point then, you know. So, you know, if I was listening to any of those earlier bands, it would have been people like Thin Lizzy and stuff who, even though they still played guitar solos, they were almost like counter melodies to them just showing off.
Right.
And so I started to listen to people like Dr. Feelgood, who always got referred to as pub rock, which was kind of dismissive. Because they were very basic. It was kind of 3 chords. It was very much back to basic rock and roll. They did a lot of Chuck Berry stuff, but a lot more violently. There was a lot of energy to what they did. I was also a big fan of Graham Parker's, again, because of the songwriting. And Eddie and the Hot Rods were another band that I liked a lot around that period of time. Although it's fair to say Henry, our other guitar player, was a much bigger Hot Rods fan than I was. And so, you know, I was listening to those guys. And then punk came along, and I thought it was fantastic, just as a short, sharp shock. I didn't see it lasting. I really didn't. I didn't see any longevity to it. You know, I thought it was outrage for outrage's sake, which I thought was a good thing because, you know, up to that point, you were being deluged by Rick Wakeman presenting operas on ice and stuff, and it was like, okay, I'm sorry. So, you know, to see people, you know, writing on a weekly basis to the music press, you know, outraged of Dunstable, you know, sort of, how can these punk musicians call themselves musicians? That's not music at all. It's disgraceful. And I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah.
But like I said, I didn't see any longevity. I thought the songs were, I thought they were really exciting. I thought they were fun, but I didn't see where it was going to go after you'd made your first record. And then I heard The Clash, and it was the lyrics again that drew me in, and particularly the song Career Opportunities on their first album, just simply because it was so obvious that they were writing about their lives, you know. And the fact that there was no real prospect for them or for young folk, you know, of their social standing, I suppose, at that time. They were kind of screwed. And that song really hit home to me, and I thought, you know, this is suddenly tying in with like Dylan and people like that. I mean, that's probably making a huge claim that even Strummer probably wouldn't have made, you know, but it felt like, you know, yeah, I can now see a future in this. And that was where it really, you know, really hammered home to me.
And what did you guys do? You started your own label and put out a single? Is that what happened?
We got to that eventually. I mean, like I said, so we met Gordon and his co-manager, a guy called Colin McClelland. They were both journalists. Gordon was the English Daily Express correspondent for what was happening in Northern Ireland. Colin was a local guy who had mainly, God bless him, had tried to write entertainment columns for an area which had no entertainment, you know, because fans wouldn't come and play. They were too scared or they couldn't get insurance or whatever. We started to write songs, you know, much more than we had done before. We were just basically covering other bands until we met Gordon, who really, you know, effectively, you know, put our heads down and made us write. And so we had quite a few songs, but then we didn't know what to do with them. Because, again, back then, you know, the recognized path to moving forward would have been to try and play some other shows, get some decent press, maybe get a record label interested, and that was how you moved forward. But with us living in Northern Ireland, there were a number of obstacles to that. The first being the Irish Sea was in the way. All the record labels were based in England. And secondly, even if you could get somebody from a label to come out and see you, they're not going to want to come to basically what was a war zone and see you. So we're all that, you know, all that stuff was kind of there. So we then thought about, well, we'll make a demo tape and send them the demo tape. And it was Gordon worked out that it was almost as expensive to just make a demo tape as it was to record it and have it pressed up and put it out, and maybe recoup some of the money we'd spent on the demo tape. So that was kind of how the first single came about. We recorded two songs in a local radio jingle station. We put it out, and we thought, okay, now we need to get some publicity around it, and we sent one copy to John Peel at the BBC in the UK. And Peel played it and raved about it, and then continued playing it, as a consequence of which we sold the first 500 really quickly and then had to do a reprint. We rather foolishly hadn't budgeted for to have a sleeve pressed up for this. So we had these sleeves printed, but they came on a flat sheet of paper. And as a consequence of which, we had to cut every fucking sleeve out, fold it, paste it together, put the record inside it. And it kind of meant that we press ganged all our girlfriends and stuff into helping. And we had this little production line set up in Gordon's apartment. And we'd get there I had an office job at the time. Pretty much everybody was working. And we'd get there after work. Like I said, you know, try girlfriends along with the promise of maybe a pizza on the way home or something, but you know, we got to go do this. And we set this up, and I remember distinctly one night we were doing this, and it was dragging on into the, you know, towards midnight, and Peel's radio show was on from 10 to 12, and while we were putting it together with the radio on in the background, and he played the record again, and he'd been playing it, I think he played it something like 10 nights in a row. And we literally all stopped and started screaming at the radio, "Stop playing the fucking record! I can't be doing this anymore."
something that you said. But then we realized that it was all he planned. Cause you can play crap on the radio. You can't play crap on the radio. Be careful what you say. And you can play shite all day. You can't play crap on the radio. Radio. Radio.
It seems obvious to people who know who John Peel is, but I mean, talk about him to people who might not know how important he was.
For my money, Peel was probably the single most important person in the British music industry from probably 67 through till the day he passed away.
Yeah.
You know, and he didn't obviously, he would never have made claims that he discovered any bands, but people would send him tapes, they would send him records, demo records, pester him with letters, pester him with phone calls. I mean, there used to be a thing in the UK, I don't know if it was the case over here, but there was an agreement with the British Musicians Union in the 60s that any radio broadcast had to have a limited amount of what they called needle time. And that meant they could only play records for a certain amount of time out of each hour. So they could maybe play, out of a 60-minute period, they could probably play 40 minutes of recorded music, and then 20 minutes had to be either live or re-recorded. The thinking behind that was that the majority of recording artists were solo artists. You know, they were vocalists, basically, and they'd hired orchestras. They were the likes of Tom Jones and people like that. Mm-hmm. And they hired orchestras. So, of course, that orchestra would get paid once for a session and then gone. Whereas if they limited the amount of needle time, then they're going to have to hire musicians to play again. So they had limited needle time. And in fact, so much so that the BBC even had its own orchestra to get round this. You know, so they'd bring a singer in. And Peel realised this, and his producer hit on the idea of, well, we can, instead of, you know, we're not going to be hiring Tom Jones or somebody like that, but we can bring Pink Floyd in to record a session. And that's where the Peel session started, was basically it was to get around the needle time thing. As a consequence of when I ended up in the late 80s, I got a job as a producer working at the BBC, and I was worked at Radio 1 for a year, like I said. And they had a tape room up in the attic, and I was up there one day, and it was like an Aladdin's cave. They had all these unreleased tapes from everyone, from Pink Floyd through Led Zeppelin through T-Rex through Bob Marley through every fucker you can think of, and they'd all done Peel sessions. I mean the guy's eye for what was just coming around the bend was phenomenal. You know, it was just incredible. And I mean eventually they did strike a deal with a small independent label and started releasing these as the Peel session albums and stuff. But I mean, it was like, I remember the first time I went in there and I was just looking, I can't remember what I was looking for, but looking along this row of tapes and saw a Led Zeppelin tape and just pulled it out of interest to see what was on it. And there were at least two songs I'd never heard of. And I'm like, I remember standing there and thinking, is this worth getting fired and going to jail for? Because this is a fucking bootlegger's dream. You could make a fortune and smuggle these tapes out, you know.
Right.
Just long enough to record them and put them back, of course.
Sure. Remember that story you told me about Pete Townsend calling you? When does this happen?
Oh, that was a long time later. Yeah, that was a long time later. That was we were already signed. We were in a recording studio in London at that time. We were recording the Nobody's Heroes record. No, we'd finished recording it. That's right, because he'd heard the Nobody's Heroes record. I was working, and we were working. It was Olympic Studios in Barnes. And the way the studio was set up was really weird. There was like the main recording room, the control room, and in between the two, they'd put this sort of triangular-shaped vocal booth. which was, you know, useless because you couldn't see into the control room. Nobody could see you, so you couldn't take a vote. You couldn't take a physical cue from anybody, and it was all just awkward. And then, equally to make it pointless, somebody had hardwired a telephone into the vocal booth, so you could be in the middle of, you know, finally nailing the vocal, and this damn phone would ring. So it was pointless having this stupid fucking thing there. So nobody used it, but you had to walk through it to get from the main studio floor back into the control room. And I was recording a vocal, and it wasn't going particularly well. And so they hit the talk back button and said, "Oh, can you come back in and listen to what you're doing? I think you'll see where you're going wrong." I went, "Yeah, sure." So I'm walking through the little triangular vocal booth, and that phone on the wall rings. I pick it up, and a voice on the end says, "Oh, can I speak to somebody from Stiff Little Fingers?" And I went, "Yeah, sure, I'm the Stiff Little Fingers." And the voice goes on and said, "Oh, hi, this is Pete Townsend from The Who." And I'm like, "Yeah, and I'm the fucking Pope," and put the phone down because, I mean, yeah, sure, of course Pete Townsend's going to call me. And I go back in, and, you know, they saw a red light flash when the phone rang. So they were like, "And so who was on the phone?" I said, "Oh, some fucking idiot reckons he's Pete Townsend. It's probably the road crew fucking about. I wouldn't pay any attention to it." And I listened to what I was doing wrong, went back into the main floor of the studio and started singing. And I could see our manager on there was a second phone in the control room, and he was on that. And it was in those days when phones had the really, really long cable from, you know, the receiver to the actual unit. So you could walk up and down. And he was marching up and down in the control room looking really annoyed. And anyway, I came back in, and, you know, did the vocal, came in. And I went, "Is that all okay?" And everybody's like, "Yeah, that's fine." Again, our manager sat with face like thunder. I said, "Are you okay?" He went, "Yeah, it's fine. I went, "What the hell's wrong with you then?" And he said, "Well, remember that," and I quote, "fucking idiot who thought it was Pete Townsend?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "It was Pete Townsend. He called back." And I went, "Christ, really? What did he want?" He said, "Well, he was going to offer you a tour of America opening for The Who, but I think you fucked him off." So, you know. And I for years I was convinced we didn't get the tour. And bizarrely, just last year, we did a show in London, and our old manager pitched up at it, and I was talking to him, and that story came up again. And I said, "Yeah, and we never did get that tour." And he said, "Oh, actually, yeah, you did." I went, "What?" I said, "Well, why the fuck didn't we do it then?" And he said, "Well, basically, I mentioned it to Chrysalis Records, who you were signed to, and they all reckoned that you were probably too inexperienced, and it would have killed you all." You know, and in retrospect, looking back, they're probably right. But it would have been a fun way to find out. I mean, your first ever American tour would have been opening for The Who. That would have been quite something, you know.
What did end up being your first American tour?
We just went out on our own. We didn't actually open for anybody. And actually, we did it. It was very short. We were begging our agent at the time to put us on the road for like 2 or 3 months. Over here, because, you know, anybody we knew that had done it and actually made any sort of dent at all had done that sort of thing. And he was, again, everybody was trying to protect our sensibilities. It wasn't just us. There were lots of bands were put in this position. And we ended up just doing like 4 or 5 shows up the East Coast, flew across to San Francisco and did 4 or 5 in California, went home. And that was branded an American tour, which, of course, is arrant nonsense, you know. But that was basically what they wanted us to do, was just go anywhere that you could get any sort of press coverage, I suppose, right. And where they felt, you know, that we weren't going to be playing, well, probably the likes of West Virginia, where, you know, people would have either at best stood and stared at you, and at worst started throwing bottles at you, or maybe even taking a pot shot at you. You know, so they were trying to protect us, I guess, but it disappointed us all bitterly, because we really wanted to come out and do the work. And I think it's a reason, it didn't just happen here, it happened in Europe as well. And I think it's a reason why, to this day, the band is still incredibly strong in the UK and pretty much weak everywhere else, because we didn't do the work when we were young enough and you know, enthusiastic enough, really, to make an impact, you know.
Right.
You know, I know it's a different type of music, but it was branded at the time as the same thing. I mean, the Police basically came out here and toured everywhere in a van. They stayed for like, they would do 3 month tours, go home for a couple of weeks, and then be back out again for another 2 months. You know, anything that the visa would allow, they right. worked it into the ground. And like I said, I mean, they're a lot more accessible than we were, but even so, it, you know, I'm sure we could have made more of an impact if we'd done it at the time,
if you'd been allowed to.
Right, exactly. And that was the whole point, you know, is if we'd been allowed to, you know.
Can I just jump in? I'm 57 now, and I think I started high school in 1980, and it was around that time that I started being aware of, like, rock music and popular music in a way that I hadn't been up until then. And it was because all the kids in classes had denim jackets that they would write with Sharpies on the back, like all their bands that they liked, you know, just band names, yeah, and sort of draw it in the way that they saw them on album covers and stuff. And so there was a lot of like the Doors and Led Zeppelin and that, yeah, stuff in 1980. But one band that I remember seeing first and foremost and all over the place on people's jackets and on people's loose leaf notebooks that were also kind of like denim that people would draw in ballpoint pen was Stiff Little Fingers. So, I mean, really? It's crazy that in 1980 in Brooklyn, like Stiff Little Fingers was as big a band on the backs of people's jackets and on people's notebooks, right, as The Clash and Zeppelin and The Doors. It was crazy. But you were right up there with them. So you did have that, strangely enough, that name recognition and like that sort of iconic, you know, lettering of Stiff Little Fingers, like really early on.
Yeah, actually, it's funny you said about the writing on the back of jackets and school satchels and rucksacks and stuff. I had a really good friend at school who did the same thing, and his favorite band were Genesis, and he'd done it in the same sort of lettering. He'd written Genesis on his school bag, and I remember we were walking away from school one day, and a couple of young girls saw this and typically sort of misread it and went, "Look at him, he thinks he's a fucking genius." He's
so what about that? You were involved with Rock Against Racism. You just Rock Against Racism tours. That's tough to, yeah, say. And that organization was basically formed because of an Eric Clapton concert, right?
That's right, yeah. He was playing in Birmingham, and apparently he was a bit the worse for wear through drink or whatever. And then there are a number of stories about that night, but apparently some Middle Eastern fan or worker at the venue he was playing had basically grabbed his wife's ass or something. Yeah. And it upset Eric to the point that he went on stage and basically harangued the entire audience and anybody of, you know, who wasn't basically white and British in the audience. He basically told them he wanted them to leave now. And I don't just mean the venue. I mean, leave the country. Get out. Right. I mean, it was quite a poisonous rant. I mean, you can read it online. I don't think anybody actually recorded it, but you can still read it pretty much word for word. And a couple of the people in the audience took exception to this, and they were the ones who formed the RAR thing, the RAR movement. And, yeah, it was something I wanted to get involved in, even though you know, I'd never come across racism in Ireland, and I think that was just simply because there weren't any black people there. You know, I think I was 11 years old when I saw my first black person, and that was an exchange teacher we had from Uganda who took our class. And it was something I wanted to get involved in. My dad had always been big, hot on sort of being anti-racist and anti-sectarian. And obviously, we'd seen the effect of sectarianism growing up where we grew up. So it was something I was very keen to get involved in. And when we came over to the UK from Northern Ireland or the UK mainland, we were touring opening for the Tom Robinson Band. And I mean, that in itself was another social taboo, if you like, that's being broken down, because Tom was one of the first openly gay rock players, rock musicians. I mean, there'd been gay disco artists and stuff, but this was a balls to the wall rock band. And right. So that was kind of unusual in itself. And we were opening for that. And Tom was a big Rock Against Racism supporter. And there was their second carnival. They did two carnivals in Brockwell Park in London. The first one, Tom Robinson Band had headlined with The Clash as their second on the bill. And they were in the middle of this tour, and the second one comes up, the second RAR Carnival, and that was, I think, Elvis Costello was the headline on that. Anyway, Sham 69 were supposed to do it, and they pulled out because they'd been threatened or something. And they asked us if we could do it, and we were right in the middle of the TRB tour, and we were supposed to play in Cardiff in Wales that night. And we said, well, when do you want us on? And I was determined to do it, which I think probably annoyed the rest of the band, because they were like, can we not just drive to fucking Cardiff? Do we have to go and do this thing in London on the way? And I went, well, first of all, we've got to go through London anyway. It's only going to take half an hour. Of course, you know, forgetting the fact that something like 100,000 people marching through the streets to get to this fucking thing. And we've got to then get across town and get a train and get to Cardiff, right, and play in Cardiff again that night. When we did it, and that was the first one we did. And then once we'd finished the TRB tour, that was when we recorded the first album. The first album came out early 79, and we got asked to do a bunch of RAR dates. They put together a tour that they called, the Militant Entertainment Tour or something. And they had a million bands play on that tour. But what they did was they would pick like three acts that they thought would go together, and you would play four or five shows, and then another three acts would play the next four or five, and so on and so forth around the country. But there were a bunch of bands who were at the start of their career, ourselves included, who, when you look at the poster for that whole tour, you know, there were some phenomenal bands on there. There was ourselves, the Specials, Gang of Four, yeah. Mekons. I mean, there were a gazillion people that went on to have, you know, considerable careers that were all part of it, you know.
Yeah, so I mean, this is a.
It just occurred to me, I didn't mention any of the fucking black acts that were on there. There you go. So much for my answer. <Right. laughs>
But it just seems like a great time to be in a band. I mean, you know, we're talking about America, but if you look at the top 20 album chart in America and compare it to the UK top 20 chart at the time, it just seems completely different to me.
Well, it was. And I mean, you know, that was, again, part of, I think, what they were sheltering us from was, you know, we'd been successful in the UK. And I think that they were a bit concerned that, you know, how we would take to playing to, you know, 50 people and a dog in Willimantic in Connecticut or something, which we did actually do. Again, that was the time to let us do it, you know, before we'd really gotten spoiled, you know, before right. You did expect the nice dressing room and the, you know, the nice hotel, you know, let us do it when we're still staying in the crappy, you know, the crappy little guest houses and the, you know, you still go into the dressing room that's got, you know, more drawings of dicks than it's got actual fucking paint on the wall, you know. do that, you know.
Do you remember if there was a final straw for when you guys broke up that first time?
I don't think there was actually a final straw, to be fair. I mean, I think it was, we'd been living in each other's pockets for, 5 years at that point, 4 or 5 years. And we were all really young when we formed the band. I mean, like I said, I was 19. I think Ali might have only been just turned 18, you know. So he was, you know, just out of 17 or whatever. So we were kids. And it went from being a hobby and being fun to being your job. Yeah. And again, you'll know yourself, that's a huge difference. I mean, you know, from just playing for fun and, you know, the actual getting together in a rehearsal room once or twice a week was a blast. That was, you know, that was fun. Then it became a drag because it was like, you know, something you had to do rather than something you wanted to do. And also other people were relying on you. I mean, that was another thing. It came with responsibility that I didn't see coming, I think. And also, but that says, I was very much the main writer. And when you sign the record contract, you know, it's a standard, you know, lament of every songwriter or every band. It's like, you know, your first album, you've got years to get ready. And then the second album, you've got, well, we need another album in 6 months. It was like, what? You know, so a lot of that was played its part in it. And also, I mean, if I'm being completely honest, the punk rock bubble that we were part of had burst. You know, nobody was interested anymore, really. I mean, the bands that were coming through, the bands that called themselves punk rock bands, and still do to this day, I mean, some of them have had that length of a career. So, you know, there was something there that the audience saw in them, but I didn't see. You know, I'd kind of, you know, we were riding on the coattails of people like the Damned and the Clash and the Pistols and the Ramones and stuff, and these guys were riding on our coattails almost. And so it was kind of it was diluted to a third run through, and it didn't interest me as much, and obviously didn't interest the mainstream audience, who by that stage were listening to Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet and stuff like that, you know. So the music scene had changed, and the audience had changed, and we weren't getting on particularly well as four people. And also, we were pulling in four different directions. I mean, you know, everybody in the band had a different idea of where we should be going. Whereas when you first start, you were four friends who all liked the same sort of music. And I think that also became apparent, you know, by 1982, 83, we realized that that was actually all we had in common. It wasn't a gang anymore. I mean, a band is very much at its heart a gang when you start out. You know, it's like it's four pals having fun, and you all totally believe in this one thing.
Yeah.
We'd all but we were believing in four different things, and right. Like I said, that's when you suddenly realize that you know you'd all your friends, all the people you chose to hang out with in 1978 were the guys in the band. By 1983, they were the last three guys you wanted to fucking right. see. You know, so. It wasn't really, there wasn't really one, you know, there wasn't a sort of, you know, huge bust up on stage one night or whatever. But again, that was another thing that was happening increasingly, was things that had been arguments that might have actually been settled with, you know, a sense of humor back in 1978-79, just went straight to fist fights. And it [S2] Right. [S1] Was just, okay, fuck this, you know, I'm kind of done, you know. And also, I was, you know, I was disillusioned with the having to shout over noisy guitars. I wanted to actually try and sing, and you know, and actually the other thing actually that really did annoy me was our reviews kept going on about, you know, sort of, oh well, you know, they're still very powerful live, and they're still, you know, the guitars still a wall of guitars, and you know Jake still shouts as much as he ever did, and I'm thinking, there was a melody in all of those songs. I mean, there's a reason why you can still fucking, you know, we still play those songs to this day, is because there was a melody in there that was being hidden by the way the band was playing and what we were, you know, the way we were introduced and stuff. But also by the way we were being perceived. I think, you know, we were a victim by that stage of lazy journalism as much as anything else. And I wanted people to realize that there were melodies in there. So the next thing I was going to do, I really wanted... to try and, you know, emphasize that and bring that out a bit more, because it had always been there as far as I was concerned. I just wanted to make it a bit more obvious, you know.
It was nothing like that in my day. Not here in my town. It didn't get those things all our way. To me, full grown, now they're going to pubs, and you're gonna get mugged in my town. So you read about it every day in the headlines, how they take and drive away.
Well, it's interesting to me that you ended up moving to Chicago, because it seemed like everything you were doing was informing a lot of stuff that was happening in Chicago with bands like Naked Raygun. And when you got here and, you know, you met the Haggertys and they were over the moon to meet you and everything like that. Did you know any of that stuff before you moved here?
No, I didn't. I mean, you know, I'd heard the name Naked Raygun, but that was as much as it, you know, as it meant to me. I didn't, you know, I had no idea of their whole local hero status and stuff till I actually got there. But you know, there wasn't a better place for me to have ended up, realistically. You know, when Shirley and I got together, and obviously, for those who don't know, Shirley's my wife and she's American, which is what left us with a dilemma at the time, was either she moved to the UK or I moved to the US. But, you know, we had to pick one or the other because dating transatlantic is expensive. So we had to pick one or the other. And I said to her, that, you know, having toured America a bunch of times now, but by this stage we had actually done it properly. I said, you know, my two favorite cities are either San Francisco or Chicago. And, you know, have you seen the price of real estate in San Francisco? So the kind of decision was made for me. And then bizarrely, at the time, Shirley was living in D.C., which is where she's from. And bizarrely, she said, well, it's weird you should mention Chicago because I've got a possible job offer in Chicago. And she pursued it. She got the job. And, you know, so it was almost like, you know, the stars all aligned and it all fell into place perfectly. You know,
I feel like an idiot for this, but it just occurred to me that High Fidelity takes place in Chicago.
Yeah.
And there's that great scene featuring Suspect Device. That didn't have anything to do with you moving here, did it?
No, not at all. Okay. No, not at all. Yeah.
Did Stephen Frears ever contact you about that scene before or after?
No. I mean, I knew the actual book, the Nick Hornby book, he does mention it, but it's set in London. So, you know, I mean, obviously they get in touch with you and, you know, they're going to use the song. So they've got to, you know, they go through the publisher and all that stuff. So I knew the song was in the movie. And as a consequence of which, my first wife was then like, well, we should go see this movie. And I'm like, really? Yeah, okay. So we went to see it. And I just thought it was going to be playing in the background. I didn't realize they'd made such a big deal of it, you know.
Right.
And as a consequence of it, I'm sitting in the cinema and I'm sinking further and further down in my seat as the scene's playing. Like, it's like, you know, like, A, anybody's going to recognize you. And B, you're in a cinema in the dark, you idiot. Just fucking sit up and watch the movie. When you just sit up.
Yeah. Gabe, have you ever seen High Fidelity?
No, I haven't seen High Fidelity. But it sounds like a movie I might like, though.
Yeah, maybe. You should watch it. Are you ready to ask your question?
Well, I was going to ask a different question, and then we can get back to that. But
okay, great.
So somewhere along the way, you moved to Chicago, and you must have crossed paths with Scott. But how did you two meet?
It was through the Katie's Kids thing. Right. Katie was working as a bartender in my local bar. And she told me all about the...
A bar called Jake's, by the way, so...
A bar called Jake's, yes. Yeah. Which bizarrely is how I ended up going there. The idea was, I'll get a picture taken outside, it'll be cute, we'll leave it. And then it ends up being my local bar when I move permanently. You know, there you go. Yeah.
You're the norm of Jake's.
Exactly, I was for some time. And so Katie basically said, you know, they do this charity thing at Liars Club, and, you know, could I get involved? And... at first, I thought she just wanted me to turn up and play a couple of songs. She went, no, I want you to do, you know, we'll get a band and stuff. And so, yeah, when I went into the rehearsal room the first night, that was the first I met Scott the same night. I met John and Joey Haggerty and DeRosa and like basically everybody that was involved in that first show. And I think, if I remember correctly, we just did Stiff Little Fingers songs.
Right.
Which was hugely fucking embarrassing from my point of view, particularly when I found out everybody else in the room's pedigree. I'm like, why don't we do some of you guys' songs, for fuck's sake? And it was like, but, you
know. No, we didn't want to.
Well, it's for the same reason as anytime we did it, I never wanted to do my songs. You know? Right. Like,
well, everybody wanted to hear them.
You never want to do your own stuff.
Oh, yeah. Everybody else did.
Yeah. Can I ask a question before Gabe asks his penultimate or ultimate question?
Yeah,
I'll take that as a yes.
Sure.
So you grew up during the Troubles, and you wrote about the Troubles, especially on that first album. Yeah. What other art have you encountered throughout the years that you've liked or disliked about the Troubles? Like, how did you feel when you first heard, you know, U2's Sunday Bloody Sunday, and are there other songs or books or films that you've seen that you're like, yeah, this got it right, or this says something about these times?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't think that anybody's should be prescribed or have, you know, brickbats thrown at them for having a go at writing about it, particularly if you lived there and grew up through it. But again, that doesn't exclude anybody who didn't from writing about it. I mean, you two famously are not from the North. But I think that, you know, they did it with their heart in the right place. I mean, it's not, you know, I wasn't uncomfortable when I heard it, but it was kind of a, really? You want to write about it? But okay. And to be fair, they're going to draw a lot more attention to it than I ever was, you know. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I've seen that I'm not sure got it wrong. I think, like I said, you can't say you got it wrong because everybody has a different memory of it. I mean, I went to see while I was still in Chicago, I went to the British consulate there, had a premiere showing of Kenneth Branagh's Belfast movie.
Right.
I went to that, and halfway through it, I thought, this is getting a bit fanciful. You know, there was almost like a Wild West shootout in the streets. Not a shootout, but, you know, the kid's father was standing at one end of the street with his pals, and the other end of the street was the bad guy. It was like High Noon or something.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's a bit fucking ridiculous. And the whole point of the British consulate throwing this was they had Kenneth Branagh there. And I went to a reception afterwards and met him. And I was talking to him about it, and you don't really want to say, you know, the bit I thought Reese sucked.
Sir Branagh.
Yeah. So, you know, I kind of edged towards it. And he said, well, of course, you know, the whole thing is seen through the eyes of a 7-year-old child. And of course, he sees his dad as the Western hero, and it's all like, what? Well, if you'd made that fucking obvious from the start, then I wouldn't have been so fucking upset with it. You know? I mean, fuck me, we've reached the stage now where people are writing comedies about it. So, you know, right. I think that's probably a good thing if we can actually laugh about it now, you know?
Yeah. Okay, Gabe, lighten up the mood, will you?
Yeah.
All right, Jake, you mentioned Thin Lizzy earlier and some of your early influences, so maybe you'll have some recollection here. But
it's not looking good for you, dude. It's not looking good for you, Gabe.
We got a question that we asked all the guests, and you're our special guest today. So if you had to pick between two bands, you can only listen to one or the other. You're on a deserted island. You can only listen to one. Who would you pick between The Replacements or Iron Maiden?
Got me. I'm not the world's biggest Replacements fan. But having said that, I'm not a fan of Iron Maiden in the slightest. Can I just listen to the breeze in the trees? I got a feeling I could probably, as much as I'm not a huge fan, I'd probably end up being able to, you know, bear the Replacements more than wanting to throw myself in the river, or in the sea, rather.
But you like Thin Lizzy, those guitar harmonies.
I mean, to be honest, I haven't heard a huge amount of it. Okay. I mean, it's all a bit frantic, though. I mean, yeah. And, you know.
It's frantic.
Yeah, I mean, back in the day, I met a couple of the guys from Iron Maiden, and they were very nice. They were good, nice guys, but, you know. Actually, I've just thought of it. Yeah, I'll definitely go for the Replacements, because I tried to sell Iron Maiden a guitar and the fuckers wouldn't buy it. So yeah, I'll go with the Replacements.
I tried.
You tried. You tried, Gabe.
I'm trying to steer you into some Maiden, but that's
it. No, it was good. It was trying to fake him out with that Thin Lizzy stuff. That was first class mind fucking. All right, Jake. Thanks for doing this, man. It's great to see you.
My pleasure. Good to see you too.
We miss you here in Chicago.
Yeah, I miss Chicago as well. Although I got to be honest with you, winter here lasted a day, so you know, it was a lot better from my point of view. You know,
right?
Okay, buddy. Well, we're back in Chicago. Actually, like you said, in a few weeks, I think the 10th, we're at the Metro again. So
Metro May 10th. Yep.
If you're around, it'd be good to see you. I think we'll almost certainly. I always said it'd be great to see you, knowing that, you know, you can't see any fucker from the stage, but I will be drinking beer in the G-Man afterwards if you're around. That's more to the point.
Yeah. We know where to find you.
you. They say they got control of you. That's a lie, you know.